This is Judaism Unbound, episode 66, Jewish Community Center. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here for the final interview in our series exploring Silicon Valley. We gave it that interesting name with question marks because as we will go into our conversation with Zach Bodner, you'll see that we really are raising these questions of when we look at the future of the Jewish community centers all over the country, which part is really the important part? Is it the Jewish, the community, the center, or something else, something in the combination? So we really are interested in probing deeply into this, and we're especially interested in looking at whether a Jewish community center situated in the heart of Silicon Valley, the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, might be a particularly interesting place where some of these kind of questions can be explored. And so we're eager to talk with Zach about both what a JCC is all about, might be all about in the future, and also what is unique about a JCC in Silicon Valley that might be especially interesting and creative. So we already introduced Zach Bodner a few weeks ago when we had him on with Tova Birnbaum, and we were talking about the mythic story of the Exodus and the early stages of the Exodus. But I'll say once again that Zach Bodner is the CEO, the chief executive officer of the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto. He's been a great friend of the podcast and has done a great deal to help us put this series together. We're really excited to have had this series, to be coming towards the conclusion of this series, and it's exciting to welcome you again, Zach Bodner, to Judaism Unbound.
Thanks. It's great to be back again.
Yeah, so soon.
Exactly, so soon. No, it's great to speak with you guys again. I miss spending time with you, but I enjoy hearing you when you're doing your podcast and feeling like I'm in the room with you anyway.
Well, where I wanted to start was just kind of a little bit of the origin story of how we came to know one another, because you got in touch with us at one point and said, you know, I'm really liking your podcast. I really enjoy it. You know, it sort of relates to this idea that we've been developing here called Judaism 4.0. And I got back to you and said, hey, actually, we've got an idea of Judaism 4.0 too, which I was most impressed by, not only because we had both kind of got on this idea of Judaism as sort of a series of operating systems, but we'd both landed on 4.0, which is not always common, you know, that sometimes people are in the same basic mindset, but they think there have been three versions or two versions or five versions, but somehow we both landed on four versions. So I think that was a sign of our cosmic connection.
And you both wanted the GPA. You both wanted the 4.0 GPA.
Exactly.
Right. So I was just curious if you could just start by kind of talking about that process in which, you know, here you came to the JCC in Palo Alto and you were there for some time and you kind of landed on this idea of Judaism 4.0. And I'm curious, like, what was the road to coming to the JCC? What did you experience in those early months or years? And then how did it sort of bring you to that conception?
It was one of the first phrases I came up with, wrote a piece for the local Jewish paper about it, but recognizing that JCCs are in a unique position to be the one place that intentionally bring Jews and non-Jews together in a Jewish environment around Jewish values. You know, no other institution really does that. And a lot of my friends and colleagues who are running JCCs around the country are doing amazing things to incubate new expressions of Jewish identity. But I thought, hey, the JCC at the heart of Silicon Valley can really be on the cutting edge of this. We can be the ones helping think about what the Jewish of tomorrow looks like. Because the reality is, our kids are not going to be doing Jewish the way that we do Jewish. We're not doing it the way our parents and grandparents did it in most cases. So what does that look like? How do we help make Judaism and Jewish life meaningful, relevant, and joyous for ourselves and for our kids? Those are the three things I keep thinking about all the time. How can it be meaningful, relevant, and joyous? Because there are so many options today. You know, Yehuda Kurtzer says that we are all Jews by choice, right? Meaning that we have to choose Jewishness or Judaism because we have so many other choices available to us. At the turn of the last century, if you were Jewish, it defined everything about you. It defined where you lived, what you ate, how you dressed, who you interacted with, what your job was, who you married. And now being Jewish is just one piece of your identity, right? You could be Jewish and it might not tell me anything about you. So I thought, you know what? If we're going to make Jewish an important enough part of your identity, what is that going to look like? How does it become in your top 10, your top 5, your top 3, so that when you're choosing between, yeah, I'm a Jew, but I'm also a student, or I'm also an entrepreneur, I'm also a father, I'm also a soldier, I'm also dot, dot, dot. Well, how do we make the Jewish meaningful, relevant, and joyous enough that they're going to pick that item to be a driving factor, maybe even an underlying operating system?
So something you said registered with me in a way that I don't think I'd fully heard it before, and not from you or from anyone, and I think it's really interesting to pick up on, which is, correct me if I'm wrong about the history of the JCCs, but it feels to me like the idea of the JCC back in the day was that Jews were looking for a place to gather as Jews and to participate in some of the kind of things that they might have been excluded from in other parts of American society. And it really was a place, a non-religiously focused place for Jews. And what's happened over time is in part because JCCs, for example, had amazing gyms and whatnot, that and Jews no longer needed this special Jewish place to gather and to have some of the experiences that were denied to them because now they were open to them in society in general, there came to be a lot of non-Jews participating in the JCC. And what I heard you just describe was the idea that I hadn't really considered before, that is actually a strength of the JCCs in the Jewish world in which we are today. You know, I think a lot of people I've heard criticisms, you know, oh, their JCCs aren't really Jewish places anymore because they're full of non-Jews using the gym, right? And basically, the really interesting idea that I'm sensing here is that actually JCCs are the only Jewish-defined place that actually has a lot of non-Jews as part of it. And there's an enormous potential there for what we've talked a lot about on our podcast, for non-Jews to have a meaningful and important role in the reimagination and redefinition of Judaism. And I'm wondering if that's something that you've experienced or want to experience more, have thought about how to amplify, et cetera.
Absolutely. The JCCs were created for the Jews that were coming from other parts of the world, frankly, and it was teaching Jews how to be Americans. And I think what has kind of, the pendulum has swung over the last 30 years to have JCCs be a place where we could teach Americans how to be Jews. And actually, I think we're in a moment right now where the JCCs are at a nexus of trying to figure out how to get the pendulum to swing back to the center. Where's our responsibility in teaching people how to be Jewish Americans or American Jews? How do we bring that together? The nexus between what's the future of Jewish life look like and what is the future of our civic responsibility as Americans look like? You know, you've talked a little bit about the politics of the era we're living in right now. Well, as institutions that embrace Jewish values, how do we stand up for what we believe is the right thing? And yet, how do we continue to be a community for everyone, including people with different belief systems? So JCCs really can be the center of gravity for these conversations right now. And we're trying to do a lot around that. We're trying to have conversations about the Tikkun Olam factor, for instance. You've talked on your show about how Tikkun Olam seems to be a defining force for young people today in what it means to be Jewish. But you can be a really good non-Jew doing really good things to make the world a better place, to quote unquote repair the world. But that doesn't make you Jewish just by doing that, right? So what are the things that in fact make you Jewish? I'm looking at Lex right now, and I'm admiring your Omer beard. Very nice, Lex.
Thank you.
And you may notice that I also have one, albeit a lot whiter than Lex's.
Our listeners will have to imagine these beards.
Yes, exactly. But people ask me, the first thing is something, is everything okay? There's that question, you know, because they think of the 30-day beard period. I assure them everything is okay, but I'm growing the Omer beard. And then they look at me funny because they know I'm not observant. I'm not Orthodox. And I say, but why should the Orthodox have all the fun, right? You know, seriously, well, it's an interesting observation to me that the observant community has kind of cornered the market on nearly all the outward manifestations of Jewish identity. I mean, let's take the kippah, for example, right? You see somebody walking down the street wearing a kippah. There you go. And you think two things. One, they're Jewish. And two, they're probably observant, right? Now, I'm having this conversation with my friend, Rabbi Darren Kleinberg, who is a student of Yitz Greenberg's. He's the principal at Kehillah Jewish High School across the street from us. And he's an Orthodox, ordained Orthodox rabbi, but he's not observant. He doesn't keep kosher. He wears a kippah. And he wears a kippah because he's a proud Jew, and he wants people to know that's who he is.
Yeah, I love that you bring up the Omer. I'm flashing back a few years because in many ways, my entry into thinking big picture about American Judaism and a lot of these questions was when I was writing for New Voices magazine as a junior and senior in college. And I wrote two pieces that are some of my favorite that I still share. One of them was called Why Are There Pringles on My Head? And it was about why I wear a kippah and walk around with a yarmulke. And another I wrote, I'm forgetting the title, but it I remember I found a picture of Brad Pitt with a massive beard that he had for one of his movies. And it was about why I grew a beard for the Omer as like a very much not Orthodox Jewish guy. And I think that it gets to some really big questions that you alluded to, which is, you're right. We've understood many Jewish rituals and many Jewish ideas to be held by the Orthodox. And then there's a question as to whether the way we go about achieving change to Judaism, if we want to see change, is do we sort of take those rituals, those existing things, and say, you know what? No, those are ours too, and we're going to do them differently, which is in this case what I've done by latching onto the beard, by wearing a yarmulke and defining it differently. Or do we say, you know what? We're not going to do that at all. We're going to define our own new ideas. And that, I think, is what Dan and I are constantly wrestling with. And there's other elements of my life where I do that and where I say, you know what? I'm not going to try and reform a particular ritual. I'm just going to say that one's done. Make up something new.
Yeah, I love that. It actually reminds me of your interview with Una King, who talked about the democratization of the web through YouTube, right? YouTube has made everybody a content provider, a movie producer. Now everyone is kind of thinking about what does Jewish mean for them? How do we create new rituals? How do we create new meaning? I'm thinking about Tom Friedman's line. He's always talked about the world being flat, right? The democratization of everything. And in his latest book, I don't know if you've read it, called Thank You for Being Late, he has this great line about how the world's largest taxi company, Uber, owns no cars, how the world's largest publisher, Facebook, has no printing presses, how the world's largest retailer, Alibaba, manufactures no products, and how the world's largest hotel business, Airbnb, owns no real estate, right? Think about what that could mean for Judaism, right? If nobody has the corner on the market for Jewish content, Jewish meaning, Jewish tradition, if no institution or synagogue or JCC or rabbi owned it, but it was just there, fully democratized, what could we be doing with it? Right? Already folks can go to the web and answer whatever Jewish question they want, like how do I do my own bar mitzvah? How do I do my own wedding? What could be next? So I love that you're asking these questions about what the kippah means to you and what the beard means to you. And I think that we need to be kind of putting that out there for our community to help us answer those questions. But there are five factors that I think are leading today to these five drivers of change. One of them is this institutional affiliation, right? People aren't affiliating with legacy institutions like they used to, whether that's a synagogue or a JCC or a federation. And while some in the Jewish community, especially the Jewish establishment, are shrying gavalt over this, others are saying, this is the greatest thing ever. The fact that our young people are wanting to do Jewish, but they're doing it in their own way. They're not necessarily stepping away. You know, I come back to B'nai Lapi's idea of the crash, and right, some of them are walking away. And I think that's what's actually happening a lot in Silicon Valley, and why Silicon Valley can be an important place to be the architects of the Jewish future, because people are walking away. But a lot of folks are not walking away. They're just walking away from legacy institutions. And they're trying to do it differently. So the first factor is this institutional affiliation is changing. The second is technology and science flattening the world, making everybody an expert, right? The technology through the internet has allowed everyone to be a Talmudic scholar because they can get whatever they want. That's the second driver of change. You got institutional affiliation. Second is technology, science. The third is, I would call it, the ethnographic shift, right? No longer is it Ashkenazi or Sephardi Jews, right? There's now Korean Jews and Indian Jews and African Jews. I mean, there always have been. And there's also a lot more interfaith marriage. There's also another factor, which is kind of people are finding their sense of meaning and belonging, not through their religion like they used to, whether it's SoulCycle, like you've had folks talking about, or a sweat lodge, or whether it's about a hiking group or a spin class or a yoga class, right? People are finding their sense of belonging and meaning differently. And lastly, the fifth driver of change is Israel and the relationship with Israel, because this is the first time in the history of the Jewish people where there's been both a strong Jewish diaspora and a strong Jewish homeland. There's been one or the other, but it's the first time there's been both, and we're trying to explore what is going to be the future relationship between those centers of Jewish life. But these five drivers of change have made us realize, you know, we're at this moment, and we need to think about what Judaism is going to look like.
I want to back out for one second and and think in particular about the point you brought up in terms of meaning and belonging. And I want to do that because we're talking about a Jewish community center, which I think we don't think about the names of our organizations sometimes. And there's sort of JCCs, you know, a blurred Jewish community center. We say it like it's one syllable. But I think there's a real question, like, okay, we have Jewish community centers. Are those centers for the Jewish community? Is it a community center that is Jewish? Is it some combo? Is it something else? And the reason I ask and why I highlight the meaning and belonging piece is because I think this is a great opportunity to unpack something we have here and there, but the question of Jewish community and Jewish individual. When we hear meaning, when we talk about conveying meaning or establishing meaningful, compelling kinds of Judaism, that's sort of an individualized kind of experience. Community is that belonging piece. And so I think it's interesting because we're talking about Jewish community centers, but what's coming to light is that Jewish community centers are not only about that belonging piece, they're also about this meaning and identity, the individualized pieces as well. So I guess, I mean, that's a long version of sort of asking, what are we to do with this question of meeting Jewish individual needs versus collective Jewish identity? And how does the JCC world play into that?
Lex, you ask an important question, and I can speak on behalf of many of my JCC colleagues who can tell you that when you have the conversation at the board level about the mission statement, right? This question of, are we a community center for the Jews or are we a Jewish center for the community? It always winds up turning into a nice conversation, a really vibrant dialogue about what are we, what were we meant to be? And I think the answer to that question is different for every community. Right. If you're in a community center where there is a very strong, openly observant Jewish population, it's going to be different than if you're in the middle of nowhere and the Jews make up a small minority of the population. Right. But I think the answer is yes. We have to be there to provide for both the individual needs and the collective needs. We have to listen to what our folks want and have to be there to respond to that. But we also have to kind of drive them to be part of the community.
But I think I've also heard from you something that's another alternative to the way that Lex framed it, which is that of the many Jewish institutions that are not startups that I have talked to over the years, I feel like you're one of the few who says, we also believe that what we can be is an R&D center for whatever is going to come in the future. So yes, there's a short-term question, are we a community center or a, you know, are we here for a community? Are we here for a practice or whatever? And we have to resolve those questions because they do drive our short-term community, our short-term revenue needs, et cetera. But we also are uniquely positioned to start to work on that question of maybe there's actually a different definition of this for the future that's going to work even better. And we're going to start working on that. And I'm wondering, number one, whether how you feel like you're doing that. Number two, do you feel like you're doing that in particular because you're in Silicon Valley and that's what everybody in Silicon Valley does? Or do you think that sort of this stuff could actually be translated easily outside of Silicon Valley? I guess I wonder whether some of these questions that we're addressing, whether they land particularly differently in Silicon Valley in ways that can really be powerful for the rest of the Jewish world. You know, are there ways in which, you know, this issue that we've been exploring about the Omer and the idea that Silicon Valley is sort of analogous to the wandering in the wilderness, you know, it's this place of reimagination of all sorts of things. And what does it look like to be the Jewish community in Silicon Valley or the Jewish community center in Silicon Valley? And whether that gives some particular possibilities, whether you've actually yet figured out how to make them real in the world, you know, that say, hey, actually, let's look to this geography as a place where really some important Jewish discoveries can be made. And what would we need to do in order to get there?
I think that you bring up a vitally important point, and it's why we have actually moved away from the language of being Jewish to doing Jewish. Now, we're not the first to do this. I'm not trying to take credit for that. You know, I think about actually Mordechai Kaplan said that people can define themselves, right, by the either belonging, behaving, or believing. I think those were his three B's. And then there was the being piece in there too. And I bring up Mordechai Kaplan in particular because many would credit him as kind of the father of the whole JCC movement, the shul with the pool idea, right? Judaism is a civilization. But if you think about doing Jewish as opposed to being Jewish, then it doesn't matter who your mother was biblically. I mean, we have a non-Jewish board member who is fantastic, and she is the one who's pushing out the Jewish values. Her husband, who's the Jewish one, could care less. Like, it's not important to him, but he's happy that she's doing it. I mean, I'm overstating it, obviously. It's not that he could care less, but she's the one who's driving this. She's the one who's making sure that it's a part of their family. And so that's why in Silicon Valley, we have the ability to be cutting edge and embrace things that might be a little countercultural, that maybe the more creative juices that are flowing out here can push back against the establishmentarianism of other parts of the Jewish community. You know, I say that we're willing to break all barriers, that there are no things that we're willing to that there's nothing in the Jewish cultural heritage that we're willing to undo except for one thing. And it's like Milton Berle said, never eating pastrami on white bread. That's where we draw the line.
I'm curious to look a little bit more about what we about this question of Jewish community centers being particularly successful at engaging not just Jews, but also other people. And I have a funny story to tell, actually. So I grew up going to the JCC in Milwaukee after school every day for a number of years. That's where my childcare was after school. And actually, a family friend of ours also sent their kids there. And they tell this story where they were down the road on a weekend or something at this well-known Butterburger place. Butterburgers are really big in Milwaukee, obviously very not kosher. They're getting their like cheeseburgers or something at this place called Sally's, big Milwaukee institution. And their kid, they're not Jewish. Their kid says, "Let's say motzi."
I love that.
And they don't know motzi. So the kid like sings a motzi. And then they eat their cheeseburgers.
Yep.
And it's this incredible. I mean, I'd just thought of it as a funny story, but I think there's actually something really fascinating there that demonstrates how a JCC can uniquely be a doorway for people who are not Jewish to get a taste of what Jewish culture is, what Judaism is. And by the way, it's not that this kid is going to convert to Judaism or something. I mean, it's that I think that there is still something special and important about creating pathways for people to learn about Judaism and perhaps experiment with elements of Judaism that may make their lives more interesting or may help them, you know, navigate the world. So I'm curious if you have any sense of what that could look like or is looking like at JCCs, and maybe more broadly, what it means to create a Jewish community that is not merely a community of Jews.
We are experiencing that on a daily basis. You know, I talk a lot about how Jewish values, in many ways, are universal values, right? The idea of Shabbat is a universal value: unplugging, relaxing, spending time away from your computer, your phone, spending time with family to rejuvenate. That's a universal value. We talk about the idea of Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur being a time of year to look back and take stock and start your year afresh and make new goals for yourself. These are universal values. We talk about the idea of Sukkot, at least in a potential modern day interpretation, of being appreciative for what you have, the roof over your head, the food on your table. And so how do we look after those who don't have those things, right? These are universal values. So I have a story also, Lex, about a family in our preschool, one of many families who are not Jewish. Neither parent is Jewish. And I sat with them and I said, "We love that you're here. Tell me why you're here. Tell me why you chose our preschool." And they said to me, "Because we love the Jewish values." And she said, the mother was like, "We love that you do Shabbat. So now my kids, they come home singing Shabbat songs." And she said, "You know, we went on a camping trip a few weeks ago and we had to stop at the JCC before our campfire camping trip to pick up a challah for our family Friday night dinner." She said, "Now we do a family Friday night dinner every Friday night. We don't call it Shabbat, but we love the idea behind it." This family graduated this past year. I met with them recently to catch up, and she told me that they're now making homemade challah in their home on Friday afternoons because that's become a part of their family tradition. That value of spending time together, of baking something together, of sitting around the dinner table together is something that came from a Jewish experience, and it came from a Jewish value. And so, yeah, I mean, Dan and I have talked about this. If Judaism is so important and so special that we think it's worth holding on to for the next 10, 20, 100,000 years, even though it might evolve and it might change, But if it's so important that it's worth holding on to, why? What is that something? What is that nugget that is going to be pushed forward so that we are proud to have our kids say that they're Jewish and our grandkids say that they're Jewish? And if it's so important, if it's so valuable, if it's so special, why not share it with the non-Jewish community? Why not them let them embrace it without, like you said, without converting, but saying, you know, I learned this from the Jews. This is an important Jewish value that's made its way into my regular daily life. It's like this idea that you again mentioned when you were interviewing Jesse Dorogusker. I feel like this idea of modularity comes to play in this part of the conversation, Lex. This idea of how do we pick and choose, right? I think you guys did an earlier podcast last year where Dan said something about how the Beatles' White Album was the last great album, and now people just buy singular songs.
I think I said Sgt. Pepper, but you know, you're right. The White Album was really good.
It was pretty good.
All right, that debate will be our next episode. Yeah.
Right. I'm not sure I agree. I think there've been some other good albums since then. But to your point, people pick and choose, right? So what are people picking and choosing from their Judaism? What are people picking and choosing and making a part of their lives? And how do we have that be a part of the non-Jewish experience too? So that somebody says, you know what? We learned this from the Jews. And this idea of unplugging down here in Silicon Valley, I'm going to come back to Shabbat because I think that we have a responsibility, RJCC, to help kind of refresh and renew this idea of Shabbat and unplugging as we're in the epicenter of the digital media world, right? So we partnered with groups like Reboot for their Shabbat manifesto, their cell phone sleeping bags, the day of unplugging, because this is a universal value.
When I think about Silicon Valley, and it's maybe the fantasy version, although I feel like in our conversations with Una King, Jesse Dorogusker, and Oren Zev, I was getting a sense that this hunch that I have is true. Not that it's necessarily happening yet, but that the building blocks are potentially there, which is saying, like, I feel like Silicon Valley is a place where people don't imagine that the way things are the way things have to be. You know, I think of Robert Kennedy. I think he was quoting someone else, though, where he talked about, you know, others, or was it Ted Kennedy quoting Robert Kennedy quoting someone else? But that other people see things as they are and they ask why, but I see things that never were and ask why not. And it feels like Silicon Valley is that kind of place. And yet, if you initially go to someone who's probably spending most of their life working on tech startups and whatnot, and is not already sort of strongly committed to living a Jewish life, I think that their probably opening assumption is like, this isn't really for me. This isn't really something that I'm particularly committed to. And essentially what I'm interested in is, can we ask those folks and say, yeah, but wasn't that equally true of whatever it is that you're working on now? It's just that you thought that we can reinvent it and then it'll be of interest, right? To other people and to yourself. And so I'm wondering if somehow the spirit of Silicon Valley can be applied to Judaism and the talent in Silicon Valley, whether that talent is sort of creative talent or funding talent, can be kind of directed to the project of saying, look, Judaism as it is highly problematic, but there's really great stuff in there. I mean, it stands to reason that something that's been around for a few thousand years has at least some good stuff there. Then we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. So if that was the project that you were given, you know, how could you not throw out the baby with the bathwater, but throw out all the bathwater and, you know, remake this in a way that would be powerful? Well, that's what they're doing all over the place in Silicon Valley for, you know, everything that we can imagine. And so why can't that be done for Judaism? And what would it look like to sort of spark a process in which that was being done for Judaism?
That's why we both independently came to this idea of Judaism 4.0. And you came to it several years before us in the article you wrote. I think it was in 2012 or something. But, you know, for us, it's what can be kept? What is that core nugget? Is it the learning? Is it the Tikkun Olam? Is it the values? And you've had a number of guests on your show that have talked about what those core nuggets are. What can we keep? What's the baby that we can keep while we're throwing out the bathwater? And that is the ethos here in Silicon Valley, Dan. I mean, the move fast and break things mantra came out of Facebook, right? This is the kind of idea, the idea of the hackathon, the terminology, came out of Silicon Valley. So they are willing to throw everything up in the air, almost to the point where nothing is sacred. I mean, one of the things I came in here saying to my team was there are no sacred cows. Kill the sacred cows. Now, they took it to the extreme of thinking that I was like a bull in a china shop. But at the end of the day, the ability to have no sacred cows and say, guys, everything's on the table, right? Don't just do something because we've always done it that way, quote unquote. Don't just not do something because that has never worked for us. Throw it all out and see what's going to work. You know, we did something, I'll tell a YouTube story because I like it, but also in honor of Una King and having had her on the show. We put iPads into our preschool classrooms my first year when I was here. Now, we still have the same crazy Jewish neurotic parents that every Jewish preschool has. And you might think, what are you doing giving these kids screen time? They have enough screen time at home. They shouldn't have enough screen time. All the doctors say too much screen time. We put them in the classrooms for several reasons. One, to take pictures, whatever, but also to let the kids explore. And so there's a kid who enjoys jelly beans. He comes into his classroom one day and he says to his teachers, I want to know where jelly beans come from. And the teacher says, okay, how do you suggest we do that? And the kid, 3 years old, says, YouTube. How else? So they take out the iPad. They go on YouTube. And sure enough, they find this great video of how jelly beans are made. And he's ecstatic. He goes home. His parents ask him. And he's so excited. And the next day, he comes back into school. And the teacher says, so what should we learn about today? And he says, I want to learn where babies come from. So now, we did not look that video up on the iPad. You will be happy to know. So all you potential preschool parents out there, don't get too worried. But the ability to kind of do something maybe outside the box early on, which is put screens in a place where people said, well, there shouldn't be screens, allowed this kid to have an experience that really spoke to him, right? So we can do these things because out here in Silicon Valley, people are willing to throw everything up in the air. Now, sometimes that's maddening, right? The other side of that is that sometimes it's frustrating because there nothing is sacred, right? I like that freedom personally. We have a cafe at our JCC that is not kosher. I think we're going to be one of the few in the country, one of the few JCCs to not have a kosher cafe. Now, we have kosher options, very good kosher options at the cafe. But that's one of those things that allowed us to, you know, because we're living in Silicon Valley, can throw things up on the wall and see what sticks, is we could have a non-kosher cafe. At the same time, on our campus, we have an Orthodox all-girls Jewish high school. So we have these girls running around our campus, you know, with the long skirts and the long sleeves. And you have both of these living, this juxtaposition, coexisting at the same time in the same place. And I'm wondering how many other places can you find something like that? I guess in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, maybe you can, but in the States. And that's fun and that's exciting. And, that, and you mash those things together and very interesting things come out of those mashups.
I like what you said, getting a little bit at the maddening. I want to unpack that side too. I'm curious, if you, as somebody who is at the helm of an important Jewish organization in Silicon Valley, if you can talk about any challenges that perhaps you're facing, that might not be unique, but that you might be facing in a bigger way than folks in other kinds of territories. You've alluded to one with this nothing is sacred idea, but are there any pieces of your work that you think are a little trickier in a context like Silicon Valley than elsewhere?
The income inequality, Lex. I think that what we see out here in Silicon Valley is a real divide between the haves and have-nots. Now, I know this is a problem all over the Jewish world, with day school tuition being what it is, and synagogue membership cost being what it is, and maybe even JCC membership costs being what they are. But I think that here in Silicon Valley, there is a huge divide between the haves and have-nots. I can tell you that at my JCC here, virtually none of my staff, none of this 300-plus employees are able to live in Palo Alto or the vicinity because it's just too expensive, right? That's not okay. And I think I would put out a call and a challenge to my philanthropic and Jewish colleagues around the country that if we can help minimize the gap, the income inequality gap, it would go a long way. If we can make Jewish life more affordable and more accessible, whether that is day school tuition, whether that is synagogue memberships, whether that is JCC memberships, whatever it is, but if we can make it available to everybody so that those who can't normally afford a Jewish day school education can now afford it. I mean, the teachers themselves aren't making enough to send their own kids to Jewish day school.
With great respect, I just am not convinced that day schools are really going to appeal to a lot of people in the future. And no matter, even if you got the tuition down to zero, So the question is not, how can we subsidize day schools? The question is, how can we invent some new way of providing Jewish education that may be cheaper and may be more resonant? And that's where I'm imagining that a place like Silicon Valley, more than anywhere else in America, would be open to that kind of thinking. And so then the challenge becomes, how do we engage in that?
So as you know, Dan, because we've worked with my board out here on kind of reinventing Jewish life, reinventing Jewish experience. And I started at it from the totally wrong perspective until finally I came at it from a design thinking model. And I went to the board and I said, what provides you meaning in life? Where do you get your meaning from? Like, I didn't even start with the Jewish. I didn't say, like, how do we reinvent the bar mitzvah experience? I said, what provides meaning? And overwhelmingly, what provided meaning, at least for my board members, was having an impact. They want to know they're having an impact in their kids' lives, an impact in their community, impact in the world. They want to have an impact. So I said, well, that has to be at the center of the snowflake. If the snowflake has impact at the center, how do we have an impact? Now, how do you have an impact in Jewish learning, right? How do you take the entire Jewish canon and make it interesting? So it's not just studying Torah and Talmud, which are important, but the stories of Shalom Aleichem and the comedy of Jerry Seinfeld and Coen Brothers movies, the whole Jewish canon. And then you say, okay, how do I have an impact and create impact through Jewish experience? And that's the experiential element of Shabbat dinners and trips to Israel. And so if you look at this from an impact, with impact at the center, you're trying to solve a different problem. And that's where the folks in Silicon Valley can get very creative. But again, we don't own the corner on the market. So I'm going to pose the question back to you and Lex. What do you think the problem is that you're trying to solve for? When you created Judaism Unbound, what was stuck in your craw that you felt like, we got to get to the bottom of this, that led you on this journey?
What I would say the Judaism Unbound problem that we are looking to solve and hopefully will start to, maybe not solve ourselves, but start to create forward motion on, is that we have a Jewish world that is not focused on impact, as you put it. We have a landscape of Jewish organizations that I believe, and this relates back to our numbers episode from the beginning, I believe is mostly interested in perpetuating Judaism. And not consciously, not that people think that what they're doing is I'm trying to make more Jews and keep this thing called Judaism to exist. But I think subconsciously, that is what we have been, and I'm using we because it's me too, to a large extent. Like, that's what we grew up learning and experiencing. And I think what we need to do is really rewire the whole machine to think about, how does Judaism play a role in bettering our local communities, not the Jewish community, our local communities. You mentioned Palo Alto. I would mention Providence, Rhode Island, our regional communities, our countries, our world, and also ourselves, our own lives. We can be a little selfish too. That to me, and it was articulated by Paul Golan, I think, much better than me on that episode. That to me is the question that we need to think about. And the problem is that collectively, we Jews are not putting that question first. And what I hope Judaism Unbound is starting to do is encourage people to think about, how do we really channel the stuff of Judaism? How do we channel it towards bettering our world in substantive, meaningful ways, affecting people's lives positively and creating a better future? That's how I would articulate it.
Amen. I think that's a great goal. Dan, would you agree with Lex, or do you have a different take on this?
I think it really comes down to what you were talking about earlier at the beginning of the show, where the reality is that if Judaism is to go on, it will only go on because it is chosen. And I don't believe it will be chosen unless it actually helps make people's lives better. Whether that being better is meaning, belonging, contribution, thriving, you know, however you want to define it. But I do think that the way in which Judaism wants to, you know, has wanted to in the past, and I think has the potential to make people's lives better, is on some of those parameters. And the thing is that I agree that I think it's been mostly a story of an attempt to perpetuate itself for no reason for a long time. And And I think that people are not choosing it in part because they have a deep sense that that's not what it does. To me, that's tragic because I think it has the potential to do that. But I also agree that in most contexts, it doesn't actually do that. So to me, the goal here is to reimagine, to re-engineer Judaism so that it actually functions that way in people's lives. And over the year and a half of doing the podcast, though, I think in a way that's even far beyond what we thought when we started, I don't believe that that new Judaism, that Judaism 4.0 or that new app is going to be invented by some genius or some team of geniuses. I think it's going to bubble up from the experiences and creativity of regular people. And so the way that I understand what the project is now is how can we inspire people to actually start playing around with it and doing that work? How can we give them the sense that something valuable might come out on the other end, that it's worth doing, that they have the permission to do it, that they have the expertise, that they are the creative person that we need. They shouldn't be looking for someone else. That's kind of how I see the challenge. But the how, I mean, that's where I feel like the geniuses might come in. You know, it's like, so can we find people? And this is sort of my hope and dream for Silicon Valley. Like, is that a place where we might find the geniuses who know how to create platforms, how to create contexts, how to create architectures in which that kind of thing can happen? And I love that the examples that you brought up at the beginning, Uber, Airbnb, YouTube, that something that I think is really powerful that's come out of Silicon Valley is the ability to create these sort of hubs that allow regular people to make contributions to some larger enterprise, which then makes contributions to everyone.
I'll say two things to that. First of all, I think that when you say geniuses, I just want to asterisk that because I don't think you necessarily mean Jewish geniuses. I love your idea of the chutzpah versus knowledge curve being in inverse proportion to each other. And I think it's going to be the chutzpah geniuses, right? They're the ones who are going to come up with a new thing, not the Jewish geniuses per se. The other asterisk I will say to your and Lex's point in particular about, you know, for a while, the task of the Jewish community has been Jewish survival or Jewish continuity. Those are kind of the buzzwords. And I think there was a time and place for that. I think that, you know, Emil Fackenheim's 614th commandment, right after the Holocaust, thou shalt survive. It's kind of like, okay, that was very important for our community. We needed to keep Judaism and Jewish people alive. We needed to survive for the sake of survival. Now, a couple generations later, we can say, we can drill down, we can get a little more specific. We can say, okay, now that we're here, and now that we have a Jewish homeland that's here, let's figure out what this is all about. You know, Danny Gordas says it in the following way. You know, well, we got to ask ourselves the question, why be Jewish? Why is it worth being Jewish today? And for Israelis, why bother living here in Israel today? With all the tzuris that it's here, why bother living here? It has to stand for something deeper and more meaningful, right? So that's where we are at this moment in Jewish identity evolution. It's not about continuity or survival anymore. Maybe there's a peoplehood element. Maybe there's a Jewish identity element, but it's about the individual connection and community connection to why this thing is so important that we're willing to keep it going.
Are there any other thoughts that you want to bring to the table, whether it's about JCCs or Silicon Valley or your own experience related to this conversation before we wrap up?
Yeah, I guess the last thing I'd like to share is that I feel like this is a moment reminiscent of Yochanan Ben Zakkai's moment, right? For those of your listeners who don't know the story, Yochanan Ben Zakkai is alive at the turn of the century. He's alive during the siege of Jerusalem. And as the Romans are sacking Jerusalem, it becomes very clear to him that the temple is going to be destroyed, that Jewish heritage may be wiped out, that somebody has to get outside of Jerusalem, out of the old city's walls, to keep this beautiful thing alive. Because at the time, the Jewish zealots were not letting anybody leave the old city. They basically said, you're not leaving unless you're dead, because they were making their last stance. So Yochanan ben Zakkai developed a plan where he was going to fake his own death and sneak out of the old city. So sure enough, he faked his own death. He had his students build him a coffin, and they carried him out of the walls of Jerusalem in a coffin, at which point they took him to the Roman general's tent, Vespasian's tent. They plop him down, and he pops out of the coffin, And at that very moment, he hails Vespasian as Caesar, and Vespasian is taken aback. He doesn't know what to say, but a messenger goes into Vespasian's tent to explain to him that Caesar is dead, and sure enough, he is now the new Caesar. So Vespasian is so taken aback, he turns to Yochanan ben Zakkai and he says, I'm so impressed. What would you like? It's kind of one of those Disney, I will offer you three wishes. And he doesn't ask for wealth, or he doesn't ask for prestige, or he doesn't ask for power. He just says, famously, give me Yavne and its sages. That's what Yochanan ben Zakkai asks for. And of course, Yavne is the place from which diaspora Judaism, from the continuation of Judaism, survived. At that moment, there was the pivot. That was the moment when Judaism 2.0 went away and Judaism 3.0 was born. When the temple died and the synagogues were created, when the priesthood died and the rabbinate was created, when animal sacrifice died and prayer became its substitute. We perhaps may be in another one of those moments of a religious revolution or evolution. We may be in one of those moments, not today, not tomorrow, not this 1 year or this decade, but this generation may be in a moment where we are reshaping what the future of Judaism looks like. And so for me, it's an exciting time. It's a scary time, but I'm thrilled to be on this ride with guys like you that are really asking the tough questions. So thank you again for allowing me to be a guest on your show, and I hope that you'll have me back.
Yeah, and thanks so much for helping us put together this special series for the Omer. We think it was a really great exploration of both our mythic stories and the potential that we have landscapes like that in our time today.
Yes, thanks again to Zach Bodner for not one but two visits to our podcast in the last few weeks, and also for all your help making this Omer series a reality. So we want to close out the episode in the same way that we always do, by encouraging all of you out there, our listeners, to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can always hit up our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can send us a note via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. The last plug we like to make is that those who are able to make a monetary donation can do so at judaismunbound.com/donate through either a monthly recurring donation or a one-time gift. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been 6 weeks of the Omer and Judaism Unbound.